Leslie Golden was a pole dancer in small-town Texas with a teeny Instagram following, until a whirlwind weekend in L.A. where she blew up online. From there, she entered a new world, one where partying in L.A. mansions, jet-setting to Thailand, and getting glammed up for brand campaigns was all part of a day's work. Leslie is just one of many influencers who got famous on the internet and then tried to flip that clout into a whole new life. On This Blew Up, I'm going to show you how social media stardom is made, from the spawn con to the content houses, and how it all adds up to a new kind of fame that's not always as glamorous as it looks. When attention is the ultimate currency, what lengths will you go to get it? And who's going to want a piece of your success? From the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Alyssa Bereznak. This Blew Up premieres on July 5th on the Ringer Dish feed. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, the Lula of podcasting. He's back. It's Andy Greenwald.
We had some time in the wilderness. But now
yeah,
we're back.
Andy Greenwald back on the West Coast where he belongs, soaking up the sun, considering doing half marathons, talking about how much he loves the consistent weather of Los Angeles. It's so good to see your face. I have to tell you something off the top, Andy.
Is it about Brazilian politics? Because I'm only marginally prepared.
No, we do not have to break down Bolsonaro's defeat. But I wanted to tell you that on Saturday night, I went to sleep with an AirPod in my left ear, and I slept on my right ear. I slept on my right side.
Okay.
And when I woke up, this is still the case, I can't really hear very well out of my right ear, but I can also hear like what people are doing down the street. I'm like Spider-Man now. So
wait,
just
what?
If I seem a little off, like auditory wise, like that's why.
Is this your origin story?
Maybe.
Is this like, wait.
But I haven't discovered my superpower yet. I don't know what it is.
We're going to talk about White Lotus season 2, the season premiere. But that is clearly of secondary importance now. So I thought when you said that you couldn't hear in one ear, but you could hear something unique in the other ear, I thought you just could hear the latest episode of Red Scare.
Yeah.
You know, just like constantly on repeat.
Yes. Dasha only, yeah.
What was... Now, longtime listeners of the pod know that I love to refer to the time we shared a hotel room at Comic-Con 2015 and 14, and I saw your Nosferatu-like sleep ritual, which
I've changed up on my sleeping a lot.
Well, AirPods weren't a thing then. I saw you put in your buds, I believe they were called when they were wired, and then cross your arms across your chest like... one of the leads in What We Do in the Shadows and drifted off. So you still require an audio element to fall asleep, but you do a one-ear thing?
I like to, so what I do is sometimes I will put on golf YouTube and just put one AirPod in and then just fall asleep that way.
did the AirPod, was it still there when you woke up, or did it go inside of your head?
It's a whole thing where like I'll wind up being like, what is that thing digging into my spine at 5 a.m? And it's just an AirPod down there somehow.
Chris, are you okay? This doesn't seem sustainable.
You think that of all the weird things that go on between the two of us, this is the unsustainable part? I think that there are a lot of like...
No, I mean, for you, if you can't hear out of one ear, that's unsustainable.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I can hear, but the left ear is just way more open. And I feel like the frequencies that I'm hearing are really off. Like I can just hear...
Wow.
I was able to hear somebody having a conversation about like a donkey or something down the street the other day. Or I'm hearing voices in my head, one or the other.
Okay, well, that's happy Halloween, by the way. That's good for that. I do want to say another thing for our listeners. I just need to publicly express some gratitude here because, as you mentioned, I was away.
Mm-hmm.
And there was kind of a childcare vacuum all of a sudden in my home.
Yeah.
And guess who came to babysit my youngest on Friday? Uncle Chris.
That's right.
Off the bench. Now, I just need to tell you that I wasn't in on these high-level conversations, perhaps due to the time zone or perhaps due to my just unimportance in, you know, these conversations. I found out about this event when I was FaceTiming with my children and they said, guess who's babysitting? And I literally listed 26 people that we know.
That's so without offensive. Guessing it. Really? I didn't make the top 25?
I was like the neighbor across the street who fosters dogs and drives a pickup truck. They were like, no. No. Well, because as I said, I wasn't involved in the decision making. I, of course, would have vouched for you. I would have presented you as a candidate at the Galactic Senate.
Sure.
But I didn't know where things were. And then they said, the friend you do your podcast with.
Yeah.
And I was like, Dasha from Red Scare? And they were like that. I was like, once again, that's not me. I just needed to mention this, not only because it was a lifesaver, it was so kind of you, made me so happy that Uncle Chris was in the house turning on and off the Apple television. But I just feel like, you know, Chris, like you're a public figure. You cultivate a reputation and an aura. There are heads devoted to you and really listen to the wisdom that you preach. And just a few days ago, you were like, and I believe I'm quoting, forgive me if it's inexact, you said, I have willingly ended my family line.
To avoid watching animation.
To avoid watching animation. And yet, just a few short days later, you were explaining to me the intricacies of Riley's dating life post Inside Out.
Well, so we watched some Disney Plus. Thank you to Bob Chapek, not only for his support of the Greenwald family financially, but for...
Indeed. No, that's right. The money goes in and the money goes out.
That's right. Do you think it would be amazing if you had like a gig writing like the Vision spinoff, but like they took out money every month for Disney Plus.
Chris, you joke, but I pay for Spotify, okay? Like, I get those auto deducts. So
do you think will you pay for a blue check on Twitter?
Oh, I would sell my blue check today for just like not even American money. Are you kidding me?
But yeah, we watched a little bit of the, you know, cause there's all those shorts that come along, you know, run before the movie or whatever.
Listen, I don't know. I don't watch as much TV with my children as you do. Apparently.
So we watched the one where the two volcanoes sing to one another and the tectonic plates shifting brings
lava,
them together. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we watched
Riley's dusty in there.
I gotta tell you, it pulls at the heartstrings. And then we watched Riley's First Date, which is a Inside Out, like, spinoff, and then we watched most of Inside Out. And then now, just because I know you mentioned how much fun you have with this about like when you turn on the Apple TV for the freeze frame of the last thing you watched, I just dialed up Day of the Soldado to the part where Benicio del Toro is like, time to meet God.
just as a, like a parting gift?
Yeah. No, for you. Next time you stop by, it's just like, oh!
Were you familiar with like with Riley's emotional inner life and
I'd
the rich
seen
canvas?
Inside Out was one of the few Pixar movies that I had seen in the theater, actually. Yeah.
Now, last thing, like when you arrived at the homestead, was there anything laid out for, like anything special for you? Like, was my daughter like really dialed in for Uncle Chris, or was she like?
No, she was like, I'm going to be watching TV, and then it slowly but surely invited me into the process. But it must have been aware of my skepticism of animation as an art form.
She listens to the pod. I asked her not to mention your Miyazaki erasure. I also just want to say legitimately thank you for this, and then a double thank you for not sending me the screen grab of Homelander with his arm around Butcher's kid.
No, you sent that to me.
Well, I was trying to get in front of it. You know what I mean?
I was trying to think of what would be the most upsetting thing that I could like text you while you're 3,000 miles away, and I'm just like, is this poison? Like, I don't know what I could have done.
Yeah. How much hand sanitizer is okay to drink?
That's right. There's a couple of things I wanted to mention before we get to White Lotus. Just kind of news-wise. I don't really have big takes on any of this stuff. I thought it would be worth mentioning that Severance Season 2 began production. They've done the custom additions to the Season 2 cast. These are pretty noteworthy just because Gwendolyn Christie, who I think is fantastic, is joining the cast, as is Aaliyah Shawkat and Merritt Weaver, which is like pretty nice pickups, and as well as Bob Balaban. Robbie Benson coming off the bench from back in the day is joining the cast. So,
you know, the voice of the Beast in Beauty and the Beast, another cartoon that you didn't watch on but could have.
I didn't, yeah. Could have. So excited for that to come back. I wonder, do you think that's a Stiller thing? It is like, oh, Robbie Benson? I wouldn't be surprised.
It's like, that's my guy?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I've seen him in Getty photos at Madison Square Garden with Robbie Benson, but that seems like a deep cut. Yeah.
Kaya, should we pause and just Google that? Like, we're finally telling the truth about something on this podcast.
Scott Pelley is like... So yeah, that's coming back. I was kind of wondering whether or not that was going to make 24. If it's starting now, they should be able to do it. I mean, Succession's able to turn it around. I just noted with interest that in Casey Bloys' exit interview with Joseph Adalian about, not exit, like Casey's not going anywhere, but the exit interview for this season of House of the Dragon, that he really threw a bucket of cold water on any prospect of House of the Dragon coming back in 23, and that it was more of a 24 gambit.
I think that if Severance is starting production now, usually these cast announcements, these are all things that happen months ago, and then they announce them when the deals are closed and when they start rolling. I think there's a very, very strong chance, if not an inevitability, that it'll be back in 23. It's not as effects heavy as Dragon. I think that they also turned the first season around pretty quickly. I think they had filmed it the previous winter. It wasn't like there was a big gap. But I do wonder... This is pretty, really inside baseball, but like Apple would definitely want that show back for the Emmy window.
That's the
real question mark, if they'll be able to hit that, because that would mean getting back on the air by May, June. But it's possible. If they're rolling in October, it's possible.
The only other thing I had was I made a joke about there being a Vision show, but apparently there is going to be a Vision show. And I'm wondering whether...
I can't confirm or deny my involvement in that show.
Jack Schaefer, who worked on WandaVision, wrote WandaVision, is going to be writing this show. It's right there. You got to call it Vision Quest. I don't know if they will. Now, I wanted to give you 1 second to do sincere, the Tom King Vision stuff is really good talk.
Yeah. I also, can I just say, like, I'm really into this saying I can't confirm or deny my involvement in things. Can I just continue to do that, including my role in the fraudulent election in Brazil over the weekend? Like,
you're going to get us, like, kicked off of the internet for spreading misinformation, man.
Elon will welcome me back.
That's true.
People think I quit Twitter last December because I had morals. No, I was just waiting. Just waiting for the chaos to begin.
What happened last December?
That was when I stopped looking at Twitter.
But was there like a moral reason?
Yeah, because I felt sick in my brain and body. And I was like, this is torture and poison and hurting me in the world.
Oh, I just thought like it wasn't like you were like January 6th, but that was the final straw for me.
You didn't get that text from me where I announced with great fanfare that I was leaving the world's most corrosive social media
Why
platform.
Don't you do... I just wish that you would do that thing where it's just like, friends, I'm leaving the parapet here. Like, I'm leaving the barricades. And then like 5 seconds later is back and being like, by the way, my Tegan and Sarah interview goes live on Monday.
Just back faving.
Yeah.
You want me to talk about Vision? Yeah. Look, they actually use some of this in WandaVision, but... You know, there's a great, great, great comic book writer called Tom King. I think I've given the spiel before, but like his really, he's one of the most gifted comic writers out there, especially for taking characters and telling the best version of that story. Mm-hmm. He's over at DC now doing that for, I think he did Shade the Changing Man and a couple other things. But his Vision 12-issue maxi series called Vision, it's collected in a beautiful, you know, bound edition. You get hardcover, softcover, whatever. And actually, I did the Marvel Comics in-house podcast about this. A couple of months ago.
Sneaky son of a bitch.
Well, I call it the Prestige Comics Podcast. I don't know if you know about that, but it's just something I like to do on the side. Just keep, you know, keep the old juices flowing. Now,
do those appearances, are those contractually obligated by Chapek? Like, do they also come out of your deal?
You laugh as if you were not, until the end of Grantland, a Disney cast member. You know, like we all were. That was what we were called when we worked
there.
I just kept the goofy hat. And, you know, just can put it on for events or for short-term consulting assignments. But the I really recommend it. It really boils the character down to an incredible, it's just brilliant. And it's about what makes this robot who wants to be a man tick. And he builds a family for himself, basically, to become human.
How many times has this guy died?
Vision?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like my electric car. You know what I mean? Does it die or does it just get unplugged and plugged back in again?
Is Vision made by Polestar?
I mean, the fun thing about it is that, like, when you have a normal car, it's like the engine breaks. But with an electric car, especially one as poorly made as mine, it's like, it just says, like, propulsion system failure. I'm like, I'm not fucking Captain Kirk. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just trying to get
jump to
the
hyperspace malfunction.
Or the time you're driving on the street and suddenly it's like collision imminent and it starts constricting the seatbelt. I'm driving 20 miles an hour on an empty road. It's cool. It's cool. I definitely recommend driving a computer instead of a car. So yeah, it's like that. He dies a lot. Not a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, clearly like, I thought his death by the hands of Thanos was definitive, you know, like there's no coming back from that one, but I guess I was wrong. But I guess he still is dead and he's just like a figment of Wanda's imagination, right?
Well, no,
and
wasn't
now
there
he's
the white vision?
He's white vision, that's right.
By the way, if ever there was a hero for these times, it's White Vision. Like, that is really, that's the superhero this moment is asking for, sadly. No, but like, that's his robot body, but not his, you know, his passionate Wanda-loving soul. I just want to say, what a sinecure for Paul Bettany. Like, that guy's, I don't know anything about his life. I didn't read the transcripts of the Johnny Depp trial, but it does seem fairly decent. You know what I mean? And like, best case scenario, that he just sort of, he hangs out in Park Slope with Jen Connolly. And then every few months, Kevin Feige's like, all right, you know, your suite's ready for you here in Atlanta. We're going to do some stuff. And he's like, great. And then in between, he just does that performance in Solo that I blacked out about, but I think we really, really enjoyed.
It was a very warmly remembered.
Didn't he replace Michael K. Williams in that part?
As who? In Solo?
No, in Solo, he was this character that I believe in the Lord and Miller version, Michael K. Williams had been playing a version of this character.
Was Michael K. Williams shut it down, on set and they shot some of it?
I believe they did, and then they shut it down, and wow. Ron Howard took over, and I think Michael K. Williams was unavailable to continue.
I see.
And so, obviously, you just go one click down on the call sheet, like on the audition sheet for, like, if you can't get Michael K. Williams. So, speaking of White Visions, like, the idea of Paul Bettany always being uncalled to replace Michael K. Williams is really a special
as
one.
Omar would be pretty amazing. It's
incredible. As
him, like, making a toothbrush shiv in Night Of.
I'm here for all of this.
Let's talk a little bit of White Lotus. Let's stop beating around the bush. I was going to say, like, did you have any cultural highlights from New York? I was curious whether or not in your New York adventure, if you saw anything that you would like to report back on.
Well, I would recommend two great things. I saw the new Tom Stoppard play Leopold Stott, which absolutely cracked me open and destroyed me. It's beautiful. It's a really powerful play. I wish everyone could see it. And I saw the Edward Hopper exhibition that's up at the Whitney.
Oh my God.
That was very nice.
Yeah. You fucking love a diner.
You know what I love really is urban loneliness and malaise.
Yeah.
So I felt really good about that. I would say though, my favorite thing that happened was when I got on a train, as one does. I got on like a uptown A train, mm-hmm. and there were, you know, when you get on a train car and there's a certain energy? And
sure.
It usually goes one of two ways. It's usually either, why is everyone crowded on one end of this car? Oh, no. And that's more of an olfactory experience yes. that I yeah. remember very well. This was more just like a kind of a charge in the air. And it's because there was a group of young men, as it often is, who were having their own experience on this train at this 4 p.m. hour of the day. And it was fine. It was just like a little, like, they're kind of loud. Mm-hmm. No big deal. New York City. One of them then did light a cigarette on the train.
Yeah.
And was just enjoying a cool in the afternoon or whatever it was. And a conductor emerged in response to this provocation. And she was a very, very small woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she came out around this corner and they stubbed out the cigarette. And she, it was almost like a beautiful tableau. She just raised her arms in a kind of essentially WTF, like what, like, you know, what, yeah. what are you doing? And my eyes went from her to the group of young men. And they did the single most disrespectful thing I've ever seen a living person do in my 45 years on this earth. Almost as if they had planned this. One of them turned around and just made an extravagant drive the train gesture.
What?
Now, what's incredible about this is he basically lifted his arms above his head and swung them back and forth like he was moving a steering wheel.
Uh-huh.
To imply that her job, she had no business there and she should just, quote, drive the train. This was all nonverbal. You don't drive a train with a steering wheel. Even I, a Luddite, knows that, right?
Yeah. I'm glad they don't. Can you imagine if a guy was like, I'm going to take this corner a little harder than usual just to see what the traction is on these treads.
It was so devastating that I think she had to quit the MTA. Like, I was on her side.
And she was the last one. She was the last person.
She was it. And then it was just, then it was just a ghost train.
White vision running the MTA.
Anyway,
okay.
I put out my cigarette too at that point.
Tom Stoppard still got it though.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we make this a Stoppard pod before we get to White Lotus?
We can. I'm jealous. You've gotten to see more live Stoppard than I have. Yeah.
It was pretty funny this morning, I like to listen to the Bill Simmons podcast. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
The sports guy, I believe. He goes by, and it was very nice because he shouted out this podcast, The Watch, and pretended he didn't know your name. So I love that. Uh-huh. I love that bit.
It's a great bit.
But then he was like, we got a lot of great content. We got The Watch going. Chris is still cranking that out. And then he was like, and on Prestige TV Pod, and he was just like White Lotus, but also like Interview with a Vampire. And he started listing all of these well-received and popular shows that we don't cover. And I was like a little hop. Then I was like, okay, that's a good plan actually, because these things are getting covered. And then at this moment, it suddenly became clear to me that because we're going to talk about Tom Stoppard.
That's so, not, technically why that's happening. That's also because you're like, I don't want to watch Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, no one asked me. No one asked me about that show.
It's got to be from inside. It's got to be you looking at Metacritic's TV release dates and being like, what can I watch this week? What can I get into? What's the discourse? There is a lot of TV coming up in the next 2 months, so I'm sure we're going to be pretty busy because we got Slow Horses in December. We've got White Lotus now. I want you to watch SAS Rogue Heroes from the makers of Peaky Blinders. You know, this is like kind of a Peaky Blinders treatment about the forming of the special services and during World War II. It looks pretty amusing. And there's lots of stuff coming out.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need. have coverage options to protect the things you value most. File a claim right on the State Farm mobile app and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's talk about White Lotus. Season 2 premiered last night with one episode. It's now obviously set in, not obviously, but for those who don't know, it's set in Sicily after the first season's Hawaiian adventure. And Andy, I wanted to start here. I wanted to talk to you about the accidental series phenomenon that sometimes happens to HBO, which is when they have what is imagined as, I think, maybe not solely conceived as, but at least initially presented as a limited series. And then due to the popularity of said series, there's just a demand for more. And some of those shows that have kind of answered that demand have done so at their own peril. I would say that the second season of Big Little Lies is an example of maybe too much of a good thing. And, you know, then there are examples like True Detective, which I think has had varying levels of success over its multi-season run. You get the persistent rumors of stuff like, will they bring Mayor of Easttown back after what was essentially, like, to me at least, like a very perfect piece of television, and whether or not they would bring that back. But I thought it was pretty interesting that they brought White Lotus back, despite obvious, like, there's like a, it's a bucket that you can refill. It's essentially like, hey, Mike White, put everything that you're interested in this thing, like do whatever you want with this thing, as long as it has some sort of relationship to the White Lotus hotel chain. And you can also go to all these different places. You can cycle in cast. But what do you think it is about, what do you think it is about these series that initially start as limited, but then wind up having legs? Do you think it's just down to the fact that these limited series tend to cast big people like your Nicole Kidmans, your Matthew McConaughey's, your Kate Winslet's. And then when people get a taste of that, they're like, hey, I'd love to have more Kate Winslet in my life doing Philadelphia accents. Or is there something like, is there something in this sort of the first season or the season that people get is so complete and satisfying that they want to repeat that satisfaction rather than constantly kicking the can down the road narrative wise?
I mean, the Emmys are the main answer. I mean, this season was commissioned and shot before White Lotus season one cleaned up at the Emmys. But this is such an incredible, it's such a success story. We've said that before. It came together so on the fly and paid off to such an absurd degree in terms of critical acclaim, in terms of award wins, in terms of ratings. I think it was the first season did very well.
Yeah.
I think it should be celebrated because this is something that came out of, you know,
it's also worth noting that I think people, it was one of those shows that people continued to discover long after its release. I was deeply charmed by Peter Schrager's story about going over to Sean McVay's house on, this is on Bill's Pod. Peter Schrager was like, I went over to McVay's house and we just watched White Lotus.
Wow. Just two guys.
Watching White Lotus
together. White Lotus.
Yeah.
You know, at a moment when it's harder than ever to sell things to television or in this industry, in this town, this is the hardest it's ever been. I've heard this and I've gotten sense of this personally. It's even doubly hard to sell something original. And this should be celebrated because this came from circumstance of HBO head Casey Bloys basically calling Mike White and being like, you write fast. Can you get us something during this pandemic year that we could shoot, you know, safely and quickly? But this is what we want, right? We want interesting, idiosyncratic creators to be given the green light to do what they want, and to have that be rewarded is just good for the industry, full stop. And it's good for HBO because, as we've been discussing over the last few weeks, you know, what makes that brand unique in this current media ecosystem? And I just think uniformly, like, knowing the way Casey and Francesca and all the other people there program, they still believe in the legacy of that network and that mm-hmm. they generate things and they develop things and they give people, creatives, the chance to do stuff that the other places won't. So yeah, are they reaping the benefits of Dragon and the DC properties, et cetera? Of course, but this matters a lot to them. So I think all that is great. I think what's interesting about the beginning of season two was literally this episode that we're going to be discussing is the inflection point of, okay, it's an ongoing anthology series now. So what does that mean? Is it purely the properties or is it something else that carries from season to season? And as a way to open up the conversation, I would say I was surprised by two decisions that I caught early on. One, I really didn't think, and I don't had no reason not to think this, but I didn't think it would start with a body mm-hmm. and then 1 week earlier, like the first season did.
Bodies.
Potential bodies, right? Yeah. Oh, right. He says bodies, right.
He said there's so guests in the water, yeah.
Yeah, so that's something surprising and different. But largely that conceit, I mean, it does make me curious how many seasons this is going to go because at a certain point, they're going to have to rebrand. You know, like at a certain point, they're getting into like Corona beer,
you know what,
or Delta Airlines
that,
over the last few
years.
But
it hasn't really impacted the bottom line of the cruise industry. I mean, how many times have we heard about like somebody taking a jackknife off of the back of a cruise ship, but they're like, but we still docked in Crete, you know, like we still.
Yeah, but I also think that there are just many, 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 many hotels in nice places. And the like, we seal a viral incubator with a water slide and take you around the world. Like there's really only a couple options for that.
Sure.
And if that's your bag, go for it. Do you think we move markets on this podcast? Do you think do we just sink the cruise industry?
Yeah, I don't think that's what did it, but yeah. Nor do I think it's sinkable.
No, it's unsinkable. I mean, other problems happen on the boat, but the boats stay afloat.
Yeah.
So I was surprised by that. And then at least in the early going, the earliest of goings, one episode, I was surprised at how focused this season seems to be, or at least this episode is, on the upstairs of the upstairs downstairs. You know, of course, this is very early. There's Lucia and her friend, Mia, mm-hmm. who are... Well, one of them is a sex worker, the other one's her friend. So we're sort of seeing them see the guests arrive and et cetera. We have the, what's her name?
Valentina, hotel manager?
Valentina.
Yeah.
Valentina's the manager, right? But I think one of the things that kind of locked me into the first one early was that it was going to be a little bit upstairs, downstairs for all of the sort of cloistered foibles of the guests. We would be with Murray Bartlett's character, who went on his own vision quest, let's say, over the course of that first season.
Sure.
We were kind of locked in with him. So that
and
seemed...
Natasha Rothwell's character, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the lack of those characters, or at least the imbalance of those characters, was the other surprise. So because this is an opportunity for, as you said at the top, like Mike White is going to show us what a White Lotus anthology series means to him.
Yeah.
He's writing and directing it all, and where his interests lie.
I think that... Let me ask you this. Provocative question here.
Yeah.
Do you think that the presence of Jennifer Coolidge and the trend, like the, you know, her Tanya character being the one holdover from the last season, at least as far as we know, changed your expectations where you were like, but I thought, okay, but if Tanya's here, shouldn't there also be long suffering people around her? And I guess the Haley Lou Richardson assistant character Portia stands in for this, but mm-hmm. because there was remnants of the past season of White Lotus in this season, mm-hmm. is that why you were like, huh, they're not doing the like the class issues of the first season, they're doing something else?
I don't know. I think it was more that it could just be that, you know, Murray Bartlett, he won the Emmy. I mean, mm-hmm. I love that him as an actor, and having him and Natasha Rothwell was great too, so I was locked in on them as equals and peers. You know, and maybe this is just me saying, well, the local workers at the place or outside of the place are clearly very talented Italian performers I don't know as well. It really just could be that. And this is something that we could revise as we go forward. The Jennifer Coolidge returning thing was kind of interesting to me because we said this in the first season, which both of us ended up loving to varying degrees. But she's an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. I support her and I celebrate her success in this show. I didn't necessarily need more, but it also... You know, it's also interesting what we choose to do with it because her arc really illustrates one of the strengths of the first season, right? Where she is lost and suffering, but incredibly privileged and sort of stumbles her way into an almost undeserved, but very sweet happiness mm-hmm. while she stomps all over
at the
Natasha
expense
Rothwell's
of other
character.
People. Yeah, right.
And that was so artfully architected and delivered, and that was great. And so where else is there for that to go? Now it's Mike White, who is anti-sentimental, which I respect a lot. So where it goes is where a lot of things go after the bloom wears off. And so her scenes with, is it Greg? I forget. It's the name of his, Greg.
Yeah.
Were yeah. rough. You know, like those were rough and kind of not cruel, because I've seen enough of his work now to understand that Mike White isn't cruel, but in the early going, sometimes
he's,
it can feel
honest,
that way.
He's honest, I would say.
He's more than are people this awful to each other all the time? I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what I understand that it's fiction and it's heightened
and
it's
performed.
Is it
beyond the Tanya character
stakes.
That you're talking about? Or are you talking about all the
yeah,
other
well, across the board. Across
see,
the
that's
board,
the thing
like,
is, I think that I sort of noted, and as you mentioned, we both wound up loving, we're both huge fans of this show.
Yes.
And the project in general. I thought that across the board, I think my like surprise or my eyebrow raise was more at the uniform melancholy that seemed to pervade the show, whereas there was almost a zany, not quite screwball, but like every character on the first season was like pitched slightly higher. You know, like
yes.
Steve Zahn and Connie Britton were these kind of like comic, daffy, you know, midlife crisis, you know, inspect my testicles and I have to get my Zoom background right and all that stuff. And then you had the Sydney Sweeney, you know, kind of like
the teens. That was very funny.
But like as this Greek chorus sitting by the pool reading increasingly like outlandish book titles as they watch this behavior. And then you have like the Jake Lacy character, who is sort of almost a cartoon caricature of this buffoonish Ivy League guy. Like, you know, it was like there was a certain like almost larger than life aspect to the show. And even as Merle Bartlett's character like increasingly loses it, his sort of behavior becomes like so big, you know?
Yeah.
And then everything here was very sad. I thought it was like a sad, it seems like it's going to be a much more melancholy show. I thought Michael Imperioli's character has this very like haunted, vacant kind of like sad, resigned vibe to it. I thought that, you know, the sort of two couples with with Will Sharpe and Aubrey Plaza playing Ethan and Harper and Theo James and Megan Fahey yeah. playing the other couple aren't quite dialed up to 100. You know what I mean? I even thought that the Theo James character, who's obviously supposed to be an asshole, like is kind of, I don't know, like it's the kind of person you'd probably run into in an Erewhon. You know what I mean? Like it's not that out of pocket. So it was interesting to see that the note that went across the board for the entire cast was like, play it at a 7 rather than a 9.
I think that's such a smart observation. I think that is kind of what I'm responding to, because it's almost as if, and this speaks to your original question about the ongoing series nature of it, this season begins with a palette that didn't emerge in the first season until later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was regret and melancholy, and certainly the Tanya character was weeping, I think, when we meet her. But there was that kind of frenzy of, we're in a new place and the rules are different here, and we're going to acclimate to it over the course of the first few days. That's not here. You're absolutely right, and it's the first episode. So pointing it out isn't necessarily a criticism, but I think that really helps me understand it's not that I found anything lacking. I was looking. And that's also the nature
exactly.
of a returning show.
Well, this
is
kind of why I brought
else.
Up the accidental franchise thing, is because continuing series wind up having expectations tied to, I mean, the second season of True Detective, for as like nonsensical as it was at times, couldn't help but suffer from the lack of, at the center of this show are two of the most charismatic out there fucking leads that Hollywood produced in the last 30 years, and Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Vince Vaughn, Taylor Kitsch, and Rachel McAdams were all like these hollowed out husks of people, and they couldn't really like rise to meet the sort of True Detective expectations.
One character could. One actor could in the second season.
Colin Farrell is in a separate class there. Yeah.
When you were talking about the most compelling and charismatic actors, I was like, you're talking about Colin Farrell in season two, right? Like,
yeah.
And a million percent. Yes, I agree.
That's the interesting thing about White Lotus. Most of the time, what we're longing for is, I want to see Kate Winslet wearing a hoodie, eating Wawa, and drinking, you know, Yinglings or Rolling Rocks. you're not necessarily like, there's more meat on the bone. Like, what else happened in East Town that, you know, I need to hear about?
Or yeah,
what,
you're totally right. It's the vibe. You want to continue
with
in the
this,
vibe in the world.
It's like, we want to see rich people being bastards in a lovely location. That's sort of the White Lotus thing. And then whatever happens underneath of that is really up to Mike White. So it's interesting to see him go away from, and I think that both things are true. White Lotus season one was also about people at inflection points in their lives. It just also mm-hmm. so happened to have a backdrop of, you know, the Hawaiian culture and colonialism and exploitation and all that, you know, and class and like what people of less outrageous means need from the rich in this world, and with the Natasha Rothwell-Tanya relationship. Whereas this season, it seems to be more about a bunch of people who have wound up going on vacation and realizing that maybe they don't like the life that they brought with them.
Or each other.
Or each other.
Let's go through the guests, because I think that the two traveling couples were the most interesting to me coming out of this episode for reasons good and bad. Like, there's a scene when they're all drinking Aperol spritzes. Mm-hmm. And
talking about watching, you know, the news.
And talking about watching the news. And I thought in some ways this was the White Lotus at its best, because again, as we said at the beginning, this was a reactive show. This was Casey calling Mike White and saying, like, do you have anything? And mm-hmm. Mike was living the same world that we were living in with pandemic and social unrest. And so he's sort of responding to it. So, you know, you don't want your art to be...
We also wanted to go to Hawaii for several months.
And we all did. But we also don't want our art to be like a tick, you know, like the Chiron on the bottom of CNN, but we want it to be influenced a little bit, especially, and the show is really built to do that. And so that scene where you have four characters across purposes, I really appreciated it, because I thought everyone was right. You know, like that's often the best kind of argument when you can see on screen, because as noted just a few moments ago, I share Theo James's character's feeling about social media and news coverage on it. And it's best to just disengage, because you cannot be artificially manipulated into rage 24 hours a day and also have an adult life. But I also believe that one should know what's going on and, you know, vote. I do think that's important.
Well, that's why you go to Facebook.
That's why I go to Facebook, to really know what's going on, to vet these jokers running against my senators, Ron Johnson. And but sometimes I hate using words like worry.
I know, it's okay.
The first episode.
Yeah.
But sometimes I one thing that I'm watching, right, is Aubrey Plaza's character of Harper, who is sort of the stick in the mud of, you know, of this group.
Right.
And I really like that she comes from a different world. And if you remember, Alexandra Daddario's character was similar, right?
Yes.
That she had worked a number of jobs. She was worked in media and then suddenly was thrown into a completely different tax bracket.
Right.
The thing about the Harper character that I wish was pushed in a deeper direction is she's still wearing like a Versace bathing suit. Now, forgive me, people who listen to this podcast who actually know what labels and fancy things and bathing suits are. I don't think that's accurate. But the only reason we know that she is different, right, is because of her attitude and because she's reading a book at night. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, she seems totally rich, you know, and totally fancy. And I can't tell if that's astute in sort of saying, like, well, they're all the same anyway. And so, you know, trying to grade out the differences is useless, because they're all there, you know, spending the same money and being as wasteful. But I kind of wish that she was a little bit, and maybe she will be, just pitched a little bit differently, or at least appearance-wise a little bit differently, so that that could be a richer thing, other than we as the audience also being like, oh, the person who doesn't like fishy fish at dinner is the worst. You know what I mean? Like, it's broad.
I wonder sometimes if Haley Lou Richardson's Portia character is supposed to be that, you know, mm-hmm. the person who's just like a little bit out of their economic depth, like means mm-hmm. depth, you know. The Harper character, I thought was pretty, I too really gravitated towards those two couples. I think that seems to be the spine of this show this year. I think that you're obviously seeing people at various points, like the spectrum of like where you can be in a romantic relationship or where you can be in your relationship to romance and love is depicted through Portia, Harper, mm-hmm. and Dominic, the Michael Imperioli character in some ways, you know. Mm-hmm. I liked that the way Mike White kind of, lightly lampoons everybody at that table. Like, nobody is spared. It's not like he's like Harper's right. take on the world is, I even thought the way she's just like, so if you guys don't watch the news, what do you do? And then Megan Fahey's character is kind of like, well, I raise our children. And she's just like, oh yeah, right. Okay.
Forgot about that.
And it's like,
yeah. Or that she's she's grossed out and annoyed by the sounds of people laughing. And right. You know, and being intimate in whatever form it takes, like that was an interesting reversal, and I appreciate that about him. I think it can be disorienting because there is no POV character that we can tell, right?
Right.
And I think that's something that is, you know, I think that's good. I think that's complicated. I think that subverts our expectation, but it definitely leaves you a little bit unsure of where to land. And I think that. I say this as someone who watches a lot of TV, but this podcast definitely suggests otherwise. But I listen to a lot of prestige TV podcasts, and even that, you know, I'm a little disoriented by that sometimes. Like, I kind of want a safe landing spot.
Yeah, I think it would have, like, so there's obviously some things that are carried over in terms of you have Lucia and Mia kind of, you know, in the Greek chorus roles. You have Valentina as the Murray Bartlett character, although I have a feeling, I haven't watched ahead, but I have a feeling it is not going to take on as much of the pathos that Murray Bartlett and the kind of sin eating that Murray Bartlett's character did. You've got these couples that are supposed to sort of stand in for the Alexandra Daddario, Jake Lacy, Connie Britt, and Steve Zahn couples, although the dynamic's different. And then you have this added element of this multi-generational family of Italian-American men making a kind of pilgrimage of sorts, but even though everything they're doing has a kind of noble father, son, and son, you know, patina of like, we're going to go back and we're going to see this village and we're going to see the ruins and all this stuff. It's really, these guys are looking for women, you know, like they're in F. Murray Abraham's character is a maybe out of fashion, incorrigible flirt and possibly harass her. And then you've got Imperioli, who's like trolling for women in a different way. And then Albie
has apparently nuclear bombed his entire life.
Yes,
back in Los
based
Angeles.
On his wife's take on his trip. Yeah, sure. So that's new, right? Like that kind of like, I'm not really sure where that's going. And I thought Imperioli, who's like really now kind of emerged as like, he's always been like such a cool actor to me and such a cool figure, you know, in the stuff he's done. But to see him get to play somebody with so much like hangdog energy.
Yeah.
Was really neat. I'm glad he got this part.
I'm with you on that. I was interested. I mean, I wanted to start with those couples cause that was some of the similar energy. And I think that I'm interested to see which performers pop out of that group because obviously everyone in that group is really talented and very charismatic and holding their own. But to your point, like Steve Zahn and Connie Britton are big in talent and in stature and in reputation and in our experience with them, you know, and that really was shiny. I mean, Connie Britton, I remember we talked at one point on being like, it's almost like, is she a decoy? You know, because she's one of the great actors, certainly great TV actors of a generation. And she didn't have that much to do in the early going, but it was such a weight, a gravitational force. And that's a little bit different in the casting this season. And I wonder if that's entirely by choice because the franchise is bigger than any one performer, or is it because summer 2020, everyone was available and the thought of working and going to Hawaii was very appealing, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think Connie Britton and Steve Zahn like really matter to you and me.
Yes.
But I don't know that that's like having Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman in a show. You know what I mean?
No. I agree. And maybe I'm just not, you know, like Haley Lou Richardson, who plays Portia, like I don't think I've ever seen anything with her in it, even though she probably has like 7 million Instagram followers.
No, you know, so Edge of 17 is really good. The movie that she starred in was great.
Right.
I thought she was really good.
But that's
not even Sydney Sweeney, right? Like,
that's right.
At this
Megan
point.
Fahey, who plays Daphne, is like a Broadway actor, and she's really great already and great in the way that TV performers can be. And that I didn't carry any baggage with her. And now I'm like,
yeah,
oh,
she's
this person is
on Bold Type, or she was on Bold Type, but yeah.
But anyway, all of that was just as a segue to a lead up to say that the dudes, the trio, that is something new. And I think that's pretty interesting, just sort of exploring generational masculinity and things between, like, that's not a story that you often see on TV. And I'm very interested in what Mike White wants to say about it. I also am really happy to see Imperioli because, to your point, like, you know, he's for a generation of television watchers, he's always going to be Christopher Moltisanti from Sopranos. The actual guy, Imperioli, is a practicing Buddhist, you know, and an incredibly, like, by all accounts, like, gentle and intellectual figure. And I love that he gets to play pieces of that in this part, right? He's so good at casting, Mike White, and he's so unique in casting, especially now, because he gets what he wants. So there was no, like, oh yeah, but could we see some alts for this? Could we see if Paul Bettany can read for the Haley Lou Richardson character? That wasn't here. You know what I mean? So the thing about Imperioli with this is that he's playing, in some ways, I believe, his real self, his public self. He's quiet, watchful, sensitive. But because he carries the mob aura, mm-hmm. in viewers' minds, we buy that he might also be the absolute monster that was described on the telephone call, right? That's really cool. Also, F. Murray Abraham looks phenomenal. I got to say, his shirts are great. Yeah, that's all pretty compelling, but it did feel, and this is also maybe a piece of not just the circumstances of a show that's coming back for a second season, but a show that doesn't need to prove itself again. I didn't feel, other than the body at the beginning, like in the first season, there wasn't a particular urgency. This was Arrival, right? Even though it was, you know, it was Arrival. So, yeah. So it didn't leave me, it left me interested as we're sort of descending into, well, I shouldn't say the ocean because that doesn't work out well, but.
I was going to say that it takes a little bit of retraining of your brain coming out of these last couple of months of Dragon, Rings of Power, and Andor, mm-hmm. to have maybe a less transactional relationship with the show you're watching. Because think when you're watching a big IP franchise show, you're like, who's Sauron? When does this person ride a dragon? What's going to happen if Viserys dies? What's going to happen if this, you know, they don't get off this planet or whatever? And then when you're watching humans on vacation, it might not be at the end of the 45 minutes, something incredible happens. It might be like, oh, there's more to this dominant character than it's him who they were communicating with, who Lucio was. And that there's not like a huge reveal. And, you know, I'll be curious to see, you know, you mentioned in the beginning, the bodies floating in the water. I'll be curious to see what the payoff is with that later on, or whether or not that's a little bit of a red herring, or a red herring that actually takes us in an unexpected direction. Like I said, I haven't watched ahead. I know that they are referred to as guests by the hotel staff when, mm-hmm. in that first scene. There's been a lot of like refugee deaths in the seas surrounding Sicily over the last few years, with people escaping Libya and other places. I bet Mike White's aware of that. And that was the first thing I thought of when I saw that, just because he obviously in season one had a deep awareness of where they were shooting and what was happening to that place. I wouldn't be surprised if that actually comes into play. Maybe not that specifically, but these people can't be encased in their own problems for too long.
I hope that's still here. You're right to point out that was a piece of the first season. Like the few small throwaway moments that actually nodded to Sicily being a place in Italy, that this hotel used to be a convent.
Yeah.
That, you know, that scene where it's really about F. Murray Abraham flirting, but she's just like, I'm from Milan. Like, I'm not from here. I'm from another part of here. You know, I hope there's an opportunity for more than that. I would also say that, and we probably said this frequently when we were covering the first season, that Mike White didn't seem particularly interested in the mystery of who was in the box in a way that I actually commend. You know, it doesn't mean that he didn't see it through, that he didn't build something that made it make sense and pay off logically, because I didn't end the first season being like, wait, that was just a misdirect. He doesn't work like that. And I think that also speaks to your point about training our brain. This isn't a show about answering the question, right? It's a show about figuring out the right questions. And those are my favorite kind of shows. And I'm remembering as I talk about it that I think the moment that I truly gave myself over, I really liked the show before, but the moment I keep thinking about that I love so much that really represented the first series to me was when Tanya, Jennifer Coolidge's character, is, you know, at the bar with Greg, who is now her husband. Mm-hmm. And it was this, it was either the second, the third to last or second to last episode. And the fever pitch, certainly among viewers, of who's in the box was really cresting. And Greg had a coughing fit. You know what I mean? It was like Chekhov's cough. And it was so funny and knowing because he was doing that to us. Because he knew the audience in a way that didn't feel like we were being manipulated. It felt like he was sort of, it felt like he was having fun.
Well, also Greg would be the perfect person to like kill off because it's like you have the least amount of investment probably in that character. He shows up late. He doesn't really have a backstory. I mean, he sort of has a backstory, but he doesn't, it's really unclear what the, how he will tip the scales. And then it would sort of be like, oh yeah, it was Tanya's boyfriend who passed away and she's alone again.
I guess I just would say, I'm realizing what I may sound tepid about this, you know, but I don't think that's the case. I think that what happened in the first season was because I had never really fully invested in Mike White's work, I had kind of a reaction like, oh, he hates people. Like he's just kind of misanthropic. That's not the case. When given the time, he does give every character some grace notes of humanity.
Yeah.
You know, he's generous towards them and he does care about them in a way that I think is important for a creator. He just doesn't sugarcoat it at the top. He doesn't do the thing where everyone seems good and then he slowly peels back layers of bitterness. He leads with warts, you know, and then, and that's just, again, it's, you have to get trained to watch that way. It's a reverse polarity from the way most storytelling gets done.
It's not unlike
on
how
TV these days.
When you're on vacation and you see the same people a couple of times, say around a hotel that you're staying at, or even if it's a town that you're staying in, you wind up seeing like the same people over and over. They may start out as two-dimensional people. And your first viewing of the Connie Britton and Steve Zahn characters from season one might be, oh, that woman's so successful, or they have such a beautiful family, or they're so funny, you know, like they seem to be like real zany. And then you just increasingly dial up the sort of like emotional pain these people are suffering.
That's so interesting. I think, I wonder if that's, you could make,
not that I remember argument. A lot of like witnessing of emotional pain on vacation, but like you, everybody's got their own internal life.
But that time we went down to San Diego and you slept like that, I think was really a whole White Lotus season in 24 hours. No, I wonder if you could make the argument that that comes from comedy writing. And the reason I say that is because what you were just describing reminded me of like the now basically ignored first six episodes of Parks and Recreation where,
Leslie's
shrill and annoying.
Yeah.
And Ron is, you know, is tough and whatever. And everyone's rolling their eyes at each other. And, you know, it's my favorite TV quote. I use it all the time on this podcast and otherwise. But what Mike Schur gives a lot of great TV quotes. But what he said about comedies, about, you know, wanting to throw away the first 10 episodes and start people with the 11th. Because, on the page, you start with caricature. And then you bounce the caricatures against each other. And they start softening and changing in relationship to each other. And that is kind of what he's doing here, but it's in a different sized box, right? It's an hour long. It's not a thriller. What is this show? Satire.
Yeah, and it's an adult drama. You know? I think it's a lot of like adult like problems.
I've only seen one episode. I heard Bill say that it was sexy. Bill was saying that this is a sexually charged season, which is what I want to hear between him and Cousin Sal. So I'm excited.
We can wrap it up there. So Thursday, here's what we'll probably do. Obviously Andor. And then we also have to get back on the Atlanta stuff because I think it's the penultimate episode is this Wednesday or this Thursday.
We can be honest. It was because of the divisional series. The Phillies playing so well.
Yeah. I like permanently deleted Gucci Mane from my iTunes library.
Permanently? Wow. And it was only, we won it, like, it was like 3-1.
Take
it
that,
wasn't
Ronald
even like a
Acuna.
7-6. Yeah, that's rough. Yeah, that's why we haven't been keeping up, but we need to keep up. I've started catching up the episodes that we missed.
I think now, because I saw a couple of, What's the Legacy of Atlanta pieces. I think there's even like a short doc that FX has put together. So it's kind of like hitting me that this show is leaving us and I think it really deserves some commentary. Again, Van and Charles have been doing an amazing job all season, breaking down episode by episode. But I think that when you think about the last 5 years of us doing this pod, one of the sort of central shows has always been like Atlanta. And I think that you know, I was thinking about The Patient. I was thinking about a lot of different shows that have come along, but like how influential Atlanta is going to wind up being. You know,
it's, and, I totally agree. And we need to cover it. It is bold of you to lay down this marker when the World Series is returning to Philadelphia tonight, which means that the majority of this week is going to be spent crouched in the fetal position on my couch.
Right.
Which is how I spend most nights, but this time the TV will be on.
But see, you can go as Jair Bolsonaro having COVID for the ninth time and just be on bed rest tonight as for Halloween. And then you can watch the World Series from that.
The kids are going to get that sure. Right from jump. You know what I mean? Just first pass, they get it.
We were produced by Kaya McMullen. She does great work, doesn't she?
Kaya's the best. I cannot believe what she puts up with on a consistent basis from us.
Can I plug something? Kaya's got a show that she produced coming out this week called This Blew Up, hosted by Alyssa Bereznak on the Ringer Dish feed that people should definitely check out. And from what I've heard, it's like Kaya's out here like peak Timbaland with the sound design and the production.
Kaya,
so.
Are you twisting the knobs? Kaya, what's going on? Do you want to give us a pitch for this?
Yeah, Kaya, plug This Blew Up for us real quick.
Yes, sure. So This Blew Up is a 6-episode, I would say, narrative investigative series from Alyssa's hosting, and it's about influencers and content houses in LA and some of the shady stuff that goes on with that.
I know about shady stuff happening in the world of content, but I can't wait to listen to this pod.
And in the world of Brazilian politics.
That's right.
So,
Andy, it was great to see you. I'll talk to you on Thursday.
I think I love the question. Yeah, I'll you know what? I'm going to make time for it. I'll be here. I can't wait.
Bye, guys.